This is the podcast for Introductory Modern Physics 2710. The date is the 25th of April 2007. So you were onto this. In fact, you're really, really close. You can have particles that have three quarks, and they're the baryons. Bary is Greek meaning heavy. Or you can have particles made of two quarks, which are the mesons, and the meson comes from the Greek meaning middle. And then there are the leptons, which comes from the Greek meaning light, and they're not made of quarks at all. So the heavy ones are made of three, and the middle ones are made of two. And yet each of them both has to be colorless or white. The way you do that with three quarks is to have a red one and a green one and a blue one. Or anti-red, anti-green, anti-blue. The way you do it with a meson is a blue and an anti-blue, or a green and an anti-green, or a red and an anti-red. What is the quark decomposition of a proton? Let's see, did you do that? UUD? Yeah, you got that one right.
We got one.
Yes.
UUD is correct. And neutron is a UDD. Very good. Many people are under the impression that an antiparticle is just simply the same particle with the opposite charge, and since the charge on the neutron is zero, then it ought to be its own antiparticle, but that isn't the case because that's not the right definition. It's not just the same particle with opposite charge. It turns out to produce particles with the opposite charge, but that's not the definition. The definition is that you have to take every quark in the particle and swap it for its anti-quark. So a neutron, you say, its quark decomposition is UDD, which adds up to zero, but its antiparticle would have to be U bar, D bar, D bar.
Do we know what D bar is?
We didn't write it down, I guess. Huh?
So then there's 12 quarks? Well, there's 6 quarks and then 6 anti-quarks? Oh.
And they each have 3 colors. I mean, they come in 3 different colors,
that
too.
That makes sense now. That's why we couldn't.
So the anti-neutron would have zero charge, but it's not the same thing as a neutron. They both have zero charge, but they have different quark compositions. An antiparticle has the anti-quark composition. So the antiproton would be U bar U bar D. Okay. Why is a neutron not its own anti? Oh, we did that. We just did that with B. Give the quark decomposition of some particle that is its own antiparticle. You were very close to this too. In fact, the pi zero is also one. You gave the particle, but you didn't give its quark decomposition.
Hence 95%.
So you could have
that's
given
only at 95%.
U bar or DD bar or CC bar or SS bar or TT bar or BB bar. Any one of those 6 mesons would be its own antiparticle.
So which one's this?
The pi zero, I think, is UU bar. The top quark, let's see. Why were most people so convinced that it existed? I would say things like symmetry to complete the family. I was lacking one in that generation. There are 6 leptons, so there have to be 6 quarks, those kind of arguments. Color charge is the correct answer there. And we've already kind of covered the next one about the difference between mesons and baryons. Meson means middle. There are 2 quarks, and they are bosons. That's correct. You got this one right. And baryons are heavy. They have 3 quarks, and they are fermions. And you do that, you know that, because the quarks have half-integer spin. So 2 of them are going to give an integer spin, and 3 of them are going to have to give a half-integer spin again. On 7a, rather than list them all, I just would have said all of them. But your reasoning was entirely correct. All bosons have integer spin. That's the definition of a boson. Which ones have mass? And you got that one right also. W plus and minus and Z0. All the others are massless. And you got C right, too. So you actually did very well. You just weren't very confident. Did you learn something by taking the quiz?
Yes.
Well, I learned something from reviewing it.
Oh, okay. No,
you actually got them almost all right.
It took the combination of the 2-to-1.
Not 2.
So if I give you the same quiz again individually, would you get 100%?
Oh, I would get more than 100%.
Oh, I like the confidence. That's a change, too. Okay. Teresa, would you get 100% on this quiz? There are, yeah, 8.
I remember looking at the thing saying, well, everybody would think there was 9, but, you know, those particles that come in, like, the I guess it's the weak force, strong force?
Strong. It's the gluons.
It was 8 of them.
8 gluons.
Things.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Eight gluons.
Is that the gluons? Okay. There's eight gluons and something.
You can get colorless by adding all the anti-ones and then all of the not anti-ones?
The two ways to get colors are to add all three colors or all three anti-colors,
okay.
But that's just one method. The other method is a color and its anti-color.
Just making sure all the anti-ones are still white.
Yeah, anti-blue, anti-red, anti-green together in one baryon would be white.
Not anti-white.
Right.
That'd be black.
No, because it's not the opposite. It's anti.
I just thought I'd bring the book I mentioned to you last time. It was a really fun read. There's the author. While we're showing books.
That looks too confusing.
So we haven't found any proof of that, but we decided that's what it should be.
We don't have a good, complete, accepted theory of quantum gravity, but we know we have to come up with one because current quantum mechanics and relativity don't agree in black holes.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have a theory that correctly accounts for black holes. Quantum mechanics works fabulously well in its realm, and relativity works fabulously well in its realm, but where the two realms overlap, which is in black holes and the Big Bang, they kind of blow up.
We should have invented string theory to take care of that. Maybe it's like an extra credit on the side. Could do that for this class.
String theory is wild stuff. I just finished another video course lecture, set of lectures on string theory. My kid's kind of interested too, so he and I watched that at night. Let's see. I was going to take care of a couple of... Okay, then let's talk physics for 40 minutes or however long you want to stay. I'd be happy to discuss string theory with you more, although I think maybe the way to launch such a discussion would be to have you ask questions, because for me to give a presentation, it would be exactly what you saw in the videos of Elegant Universe. But if you have questions about what you saw in the Elegant Universe, we could entertain those. But seeing as how this is also our review day, you could ask things about anything in the book, any chapter you want. So do you want to talk about string theory or prior chapters? I guess string theory is not in here. String theory or something in the book, or none of the above and go home. There are websites about string theory that are linked to from my website, one of which is the Elegant Universe PBS site. But you ought to go to the other sites too. There's some good string theory sites that you ought to study.
How was string theory motivated, like, to what came up with it? I can't remember exactly from the videos. Just too long ago.
It's one attempt to do this.
But where was they?
It's one
they,
attempt to do this.
Did they specifically sit down and say, we're going to try and solve this problem, and then they said, oh, this math seems to do it, or was it...
It was that one guy. Didn't it start with the one dude?
The Italian guy and
the
his...
The drink.
Oh, Leonard Susskind?
At least that's what that video kind of...
He kind of was one of the early ones that realized what was afoot, realized that string theory, what it implied, that particles weren't a fundamental thing, that it was strings. And he was the one that was so disappointed that everyone didn't recognize his genius. Actually, the history goes back much earlier. If you remember Einstein's general relativity and the four dimensions of space-time that he envisioned with bent space and all that, a couple of guys by the name of Kaluza and Klein said, gee, wouldn't it be nice if Maxwell's equations popped up too? And I don't know the exact history, the chronology of it, but... To me, this is just absolutely astounding, and I haven't really studied the math very much, so I don't have a full appreciation of this, but just the snippet, just the idea seems astounding. If you do general relativity in five dimensions instead of four, you get Maxwell's equations. They fall out of the fifth dimension. Mm. I find that rather intriguing.
I had no idea.
Now, that's not string theory, but it is the idea that by admitting the possibility of more dimensions, you might unify more ideas into one coherent whole. And the goal here, after all, is to unify everything so that we can explain nature with one small set of equations. We want all of the fundamental forces of nature to be unified in the sense that electricity and magnetism are certainly unified, but even beyond that, we've now got a mathematical framework, a mathematical model that unifies the weak force in there too. So we have the electro-weak unification complete. That's what Weinberg got his Nobel Prize for. And there's a fairly decent model called the Standard Model, which takes that electro-weak unification and also kind of adds in the strong force. At least it kind of accounts for it. And but it doesn't do gravity. And so the quest is to unify all the fundamental forces of nature. We know we have to have an explanation that does gravity as well as all of the other forces. And gravity is very weak, and so it's difficult to do. Our faith is that it can be done. So we're trying to find quantum field theories for gravitation and string theory. The thing about string theory is, again, it postulates more dimensions, but in the process of postulating more dimensions, you get gravity out, see? Just like you get Maxwell's equations, if you add more dimensions to Einstein's equations. Well, if you are willing to make that leap to more dimensions, then you can have a quantum theory of gravity. The problem with string theory is that there's no experimental evidence that says it's really true. This is a little slide about the unification of the forces. What we know today are four fundamental forces of nature, here on the right, and the temperature of the universe is 2.7 Kelvin, and these are separate forces, and they manifest themselves differently, and they each have their own force carrier boson. We have the gluons for the strong force. We have the gluons, and we have the W and the Z, sorry, the photons, the W and the Z, and the gravitons. Even this purple thing right here, electromagnetic, you know, it took us a few centuries of fiddling around before we realized that that was one force. We'd seen static electricity for a long time before that. We'd known about lodestones, compasses, for a long time. But it wasn't until the 1820s that we realized that they were the same thing. Now, they are the same thing. They're all part of the same electromagnetic field, so we don't talk about electricity separately anymore or magnetism separately. It's electromagnetism. But that they're unified in physical fact. The way we've unified the weak force with those, right here, is only in theory. That is to say, we postulate what would happen if the universe were 10 to the 15th Kelvin, or can we create that kind of temperature in our atom smashers? And if we do, then yes, we see that the photons and the W and the Z bosons actually become interchangeable. And you can't tell the difference between them at this kind of temperature. And so the electromagnetic force and the weak force are one and the same force at that temperature. But the universe is cooled, and it's not that temperature anymore, so these froze out separately, broke the symmetry. This is a broken symmetry. And I guess what I'm trying to say is if the universe cooled down even more as time goes on, maybe the universe gets to be a thousandth of a Kelvin or something. Maybe, and I don't know this for a fact, but maybe the electromagnetic force might break its symmetry and freeze out, and they would be truly separate forces. And maybe some generation hence, when the universe is a lot colder, might claim that there's five fundamental forces instead of four, because this one split off into the electric force and the magnetic force. So what I'm saying is, if you lived a long time ago, like shortly after the Big Bang, a billionth of a second or a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, then the universe would be hot. It would be 10 to the 15th Kelvin. And if you were having this discussion in such a classroom, in such a universe, you would say what I just said. You would say, well, we know about the electroweak force. There's only three fundamental forces in nature. There's the strong, the electroweak, and the gravitational force. Maybe in some future generation, when the universe cools down to 3 Kelvin, maybe our middle force here will break its symmetry and become two separate forces. Maybe it will become an electromagnetic force and a weak force. That was with the conversation that you would have had a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang in a universe that was 10 to 15th Kelvin hot when there are only three fundamental forces. Is this making any sense? And then the goal then is to also unify the strong force in here. These are called grand unified theories, GUTs. Lots of t-shirts around at conferences that say physicists have guts. And it would be a much higher temperature, you know, 10 to the 25th power of Kelvins. At that temperature, even the gluons would become interchangeable with the weak bosons, the W's and the Z's. and the photons, they'd be interchangeable. You wouldn't be able to tell the difference. The forces would act the same. They would be effectively unified, and you couldn't tell the difference between any of these three forces. You'd really only have two back then. You'd have this one, the strong electroweak force, and the gravitational force would be the only two forces in your universe. This would be at 10 to the minus 35 seconds after the Big Bang, and again at a temperature that's quite hot. And so we're working on doing this in our math, just like we've done this one in our math, but not physically. This unification between electricity and magnetism is a physical reality, but we've got the standard model that combines those here, and we even have discovered the particles that it predicted, so we're pretty sure about that. Well, then, of course, the goal is to have one force back here that's just one grand unified force. That would be 10 to the minus 43rd seconds after the Big Bang, the Planck time, and it would be a very hot universe, 10 to the 30th or 32nd Kelvins. The goal here, then, Miles, is to come up with a unified force. Do we know that this has to be the case? No. Maybe we don't live in a universe where they can be unified. Maybe they're truly separate fundamental forces, and we better just get used to it. But we haven't concluded that yet. We haven't resigned ourselves to that fate. And physicists seem to have a real drive for elegance, simplicity, and symmetry. And that drive has served us well for the past 100 years. And this process of trying to come up with a unification has been fruitful, and it's worked well. So what I'm saying is that the string theory is one of those approaches to construct a quantum theory of gravity, which would in effect, you know, explain all of the forces of nature in one set of equations. String theory does that. You get gravity out of string theory by postulating that the universe is not made of point particles, but is made of one-dimensional extended strings. This guy I just watched calls them pasta, like spaghetti. And they have different vibrational modes. You think of waves, standing waves on a violin string. Well, these little fundamental strings that are really, really, really tiny, much, 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 much tinier than anything we've ever been able to probe at all, zillions of times smaller. So we'll never be able to see one, but they have different vibrational modes, and one mode might be an up quark, another mode might be an electron, a third mode might be a neutrino, a fourth mode of vibration might be a gluon, a fifth mode might be a graviton. And in fact, you look at all these different modes of oscillation, and indeed, you get gravity out of this theory as well as the standard model. So the appeal of string theory is that it does achieve this unification. It gives you a quantum field of a quantum theory of gravity, which is what we're all after. And so you say, well, great. Well, then we're done. Let's go home. Turn off the lights and tell the world to give us real jobs now. Physics is through. The problem is that we're not sure string theory is actually right because it's difficult to test it against reality. But the math is very beautiful. And if you go judge by the elegance and the coincidences, the mathematical coincidences that have to converge together to make string theory, it's just mind-boggling that so many cool, neat, interesting math things all come together from disparate fields of math, totally different ideas of throughout the ages. Mathematical ideas have been, you know, far flung and far afield. All these things have to come together and converge and produce the right predictions. And they do. And you come up with a coherent mathematical theory that says the universe is made of strings. So from an elegance, beauty argument, string theory just absolutely has to be right. But the critics say, until you test it, or until it's even testable, it's not science, it's philosophy.
What's long the time answer to right your question. Now?
What?
What's the time right now? I would say where all those other ones were right at the beginning. I don't know if it would change more, would it? Unless it's way, way down the road.
We're pretty close to absolute zero as well.
Yeah.
I don't know how much more room you have to get colder, but I guess you could run decimals out on a fraction of a Kelvin. It was a long answer to your question, Miles. Did you have anything else to ask about it?
Answered it pretty well.
The Higgs field, is that part of the standard model, or is that from string theory?
The Higgs field, I hope you read about, have some passing familiarity with. It's often not a part of a discussion on particle physics. Some treatments just leave it out, which is a little bit unfortunate. The Higgs field was invented because Without it, we don't have any good explanation as to why particles have the masses that they do in the standard model. We know what the masses are because we've measured them empirically, experimentally. We know what the mass of a proton is. We know what the mass of an electron, et cetera, et cetera. We know what these masses are, but it's because we measured them. We did not calculate them a priori ahead of time in the math and say these have to be the masses and then go out and check. It's not the way it worked. And in fact, the standard model, as beautiful as it is and as much as it accounts for and is as precise and accurate as it is, it does not tell you what the masses of the particles have to be. You can go measure them and then plug them back into the model and still get consistency, but it doesn't demand that they be any particular values. Maybe some people aren't bothered by this, but physicists are. Physicists want their theory to predict everything. The physicists want the theory to say the mass of the proton has to be this number. Now you go out and measure it and see that it's right. And the standard model doesn't do that. In fact, the standard model doesn't even have any theoretical or conceptual explanation for why particles have mass at all or why they might have different masses from each other. So hence the Higgs field. We think the Higgs field is a field that pervades all of the universe, all of space-time. And it's kind of a inertia-type thing. As these particles have to wade through the Higgs field, they're retarded. It's like a viscous fluid kind of thing. And that retarding thing acts like inertia, and that's mass. They have a hard time getting through because of their mass. So the Higgs field is the explanation, and it does make some predictions. We're hoping that the Higgs field idea is right. We think it probably is. It fits in well with the standard model, kind of as a tack-on thing to help explain the masses of things. But again, the Higgs field has not been experimentally verified. It's not in the same boat as string theory, though, at least to most physicists, because while the Higgs field has not yet been experimentally verified, nearly everybody admits that it is testable, that if we could get a bigger atom smasher, then we can go look for the predictions that the Higgs theory makes and verify or falsify. You know, it's testable. Whereas the same critics might say that string theory will never be testable, isn't verifiable even hundreds of years from now, and therefore isn't science. But I think I mentioned the other day that this new atom smasher in Switzerland, the European collaboration CERN, has been ramping up and souping up their accelerator to a higher energy, and they think that by August of this year, they might be able to detect the Higgs particle. So watch the news for CERN in August.
So Higgs particle is a different field.
Higgs particle is the quantum of the Higgs field.
Which is the mass field.
Which is the field that makes particles appear to have mass.
Different than like a graviton.
Yes.
But the string theories, they were thinking if we can find a graviton, then that will help their theory. Isn't that what that video was saying?
Will help the string theory?
Mm-hmm. The absence of the electron or graviton.
Yeah. An interesting thing about string theory that we could have said in Chapter 14 when we did the standard model in particle physics is that an idea of supersymmetry. Physicists overuse the word super. Everything's super. But this is supersymmetry. String theory demands supersymmetry, but supersymmetry doesn't demand string theory. That is to say that if we can verify that supersymmetry is a feature of our universe, that's helpful and supportive evidence might lead credence to the string theory, but it doesn't prove string theory. Whereas, on the other hand, if supersymmetry is wrong, then string theory is wrong. What is supersymmetry? Well, it's the idea that every particle we named earlier today, all 36 quarks, plus the leptons, the electron and the anti-electron, the neutrino and the anti-neutrino, the muon and the all those, so you can add all those up, that every one of those has a symmetric partner that's off in spin by half an integer. That is to say, every one of the fermions would have a bosonic superpartner, and every boson that we know about would have a fermionic superpartner. So it basically doubles the number of particles in the universe.
Are those the sparticles?
Yeah.
Those are the sparticles. Yeah, those are the sparticles.
The
photinos and the gravitinos and the wenos. The W, that's W-enos. The wenos and the xenos. And the selectrons, and the sneutrinos, and the sprotons.
Starting to sound like a Dr. Seuss.
I know.
And the squarks. So we double all those particles, and, you know, at some point you almost have to throw up your hands in despair again, just like Fermi did back when they first started in the 50s discovering all these particles in the atom smashers. And he threw up his hands and said, if I'd wanted to learn the names of all these particles, I would have been a botanist. And so we simplified it down to just a few quarks and a few leptons. Oh, nice package, but now there's red ones and blue ones and green ones and anti ones and super particle ones, and the number's getting pretty big again. But
another fundamental one then, huh?
A simplification, a unification. This supersymmetry idea is testable, and we're looking for that, and maybe that's part of this CERN thing in August. We'll see what they produce in this new atom smasher. But there are other theories that would argue for supersymmetry as well. So I want you to understand this little point, that supersymmetry can be true independent of string theory. All these particles might be there. They might be more massive. That's why we haven't discovered them yet. They might all be there, and still string theory could be wrong. But string theory demands the supersymmetry, and so if supersymmetry turns out to be right, and we can find this out in a few months or years, then it won't prove string theory, but it will help it. String theory, the math, is apparently way, way beyond me, you know, like super-duper math, but it's apparently so elegant and so beautiful, and like I say, disparate parts of fields of math come together in interesting mathematical coincidences, that the elegance and the beauty, just most of the string theorists who work on this just can't imagine that it could possibly be wrong, because it's so beautiful. It's like Einstein and his theory of general relativity, when they were going to test it in 1919 with the eclipse and the star behind the sun and the bent light, and he just went to bed because he wasn't worried about it. You know, he knew it was true. The theory is correct, was his comment. It was so beautiful, so elegant mathematically, that it just simply had to be right. Well, the string people feel that way about string theory, but their problem is proving it. It was interesting, last year, we, as a campus, we all read the book Inherit the Wind, and the play was on campus, Inherit the Wind. It was all about the Scopes trial, the monkey trial in 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee, and evolution, and, of course, the modern antithesis of evolution. They call it intelligent design now. And so there's big discussion on campus about that last year. Well, it was an interesting question, was, is intelligent design science? And scientists generally say no. Some of the intelligent design people try to make it science and don't mention the creator and things like that in there because they want it to be scientific. But most scientists would tell you that the definition of science does not allow for intelligent design to be science because it's not testable. Well, is string theory science? Is string theory better than intelligent design? So it was an interesting discussion last year. What else do you want to know about?
What's on the final?
Well, I didn't bring a copy and I couldn't spout it off, but maybe I can send you a little study guide.
I had a thought. It doesn't really make sense that there's only going to be one fundamental particle, but it kind of does in a way too. The reason it doesn't is because it's like, if there was only flour, how could you make all of this stuff out of flour? You can't, but then at the same time...
There has to be some variation.
Yeah. So the different amounts, I guess, would be different things.
Or in the string case, different vibrational modes.
Mm-hmm.
See, the problem with quantum mechanics and gravity not agreeing with each other is that quantum mechanics talks about all this fluctuation and gravity wants a smooth thing, and you have infinities when you have zero volume and stuff like that, infinite density, and black holes are infinitely curved and infinitely dense. It's the infinities that really cause you problems when you try to combine the two theories. And so just by simply smearing them out and saying, okay, it's not zero, you know, the volume's not zero, it's spread out, and it solves a whole bunch of problems, although it does demand various numbers of dimensions, 26 to 10 to 11. Some of which might be coiled up so small that we can't see them, but you just say, okay, it's spread out, it's not zero, and that gets rid of a lot of your dividing by zero problems. But if you're going to stretch it out into one dimension, why not two? And then why not three? And that's where the brain idea came from. In fact, the word comes from membranes, like they said in the video, but they often talk about one brains or zero brains. Zero brains would be points, one brains would be lines, two brains would be surfaces. Or in general, you could just have, you know, a variable, N brains. Only physicists are always clever, and they use the letter P instead. So physicists have P brains.
That's why I'm not majoring in physics. I can think of the clever
not
names.
Clever enough. Huh?
I know, that's exactly it.
We're watching the third part of the universe thing, it's sort of, I mean, on the end of cosmology, so philosophically, you don't simplify anything, because by the time you have all those alternate universes and all this, it's, you can still go back and say, how did all that start, and how are you any closer to that answer? I mean, I couldn't see, as far as cosmology, it ended up so elegant.
I think you have a good point. It almost seems like whatever answer you come up with, you can always say, well, okay, but why is that? Well, okay, but why is that? Well, okay, but why is that?
Yeah, why is there strings?
Now we have crashing brains. You made them crash.
Yeah. So I think your point is well taken. I agree to some extent. But on the other hand, and crashing brains is really kind of speculative and far out there. Who knows if that will ever enter the mainstream. But my counterpoint, while I totally agree with what you said, my counterpoint on the other side of the argument would be that we really do think science is progressing, and that our successive sequence of theories does better approximate reality, and that, you know, whether it's crashing brains or some other thing that we end up with in 100 years or something, that it really will explain the universe better than what we have today, and what we have today really does explain the universe better than what Einstein had, and that really did explain the universe better than what Newton had, and Newton was great. So we think we have good stuff, and it's getting better. I don't know where it'll end. Maybe you can always say, yeah, but why is that? And like I mentioned last time, sometimes these questions were deemed to be unscientific, as like that's a religious or a philosophy question. Sometimes those end up becoming science questions, though, as they think about it in new ways. Say, maybe we can't address that from science. So I don't know where it will end up. All I know is it's going to be an exciting ride, and you should all buckle up and hang on for dear life and keep reading. Read the Brian Greene books. Read Elegant Universe first for string theory, and then read The Fabric of the Cosmos for just a general overall thing. And then I'm reading a book now that Miles would absolutely love. It's called The Road to Reality, The Mathematics of Everything, or something like that. It's by a physicist who holds a chair in mathematics in England. His name is Roger Penrose. He's done some excellent cutting-edge math research on his own, and tessellations and tiling with non-periodic squares and stuff. But he's also done a lot of good physics, too. And so he's got this huge, thick tome that I think it's amazing that math even matches up with reality at all. I mean, math is an abstract invention of the human mind, and to me, there's no logical reason why it has to match up with the world. We could sit around and invent mathematical concepts all day long, totally divorced from the world. There's just no connection between our thoughts and physical reality, except that it really works. Mathematics explains our universe.
Didn't the axioms, though, we start with in math kind of come from our experience of reality, though? Or that kind of explain it?
It's kind of...
Maybe.
And see, with there's something else that I was thinking about that, where you start from somewhere. I think I had to do with the Higgs particles, but that was a while ago. I forgot what I was thinking.
Well, let us know if it comes
back. The mass thing. People are like, we want to have an equation for mass, but the beginning of those equations came from somewhere, and you can't create something out of nothing. Like, you got to start somewhere. Does that make sense? But I guess if you want an equation for mass, then you can look for it.
But some of this math was invented centuries ago in a totally different context, sometimes not having anything to do with physics at all, or sometimes totally different areas of physics, and then all of a sudden we find that math useful in string theory, for example. And the example in the videos was the gamma function, which you guys all sport on your math jock t-shirts, and you think that what it's good for is giving you the factorial, but it shows up in string theory. It's just amazing stuff. Did I ever tell you last semester when we first learned about cross products of vectors that there's a better way to multiply vectors than cross products? Because cross products only work in three dimensions. You can't do a cross product in two dimensions. You can't do a cross product in four dimensions. It only works in three. And what if you want to work in a space that's different than three? So cross products are really kind of crippled. But they were invented at about the same time as a totally different style of mathematics called geometric algebra that works in any dimension. And it was more of a historical quirk that the vector stuff, the stuff we know, kind of won out and got printed in all the textbooks and used in all of the physics. It does an adequate job in some things. Cross products, you can use those to describe torques and pointing vectors and stuff like that. But this other method is much more general and much cleverer and seems to be able to describe all of the physics as well, if not easier. So, mm-hmm. Anything from the book that you're worried about?
Oh, I was really confused.
Oh,
I was like, I swear I heard something. Everybody's like looking at me like.
At least I remembered to turn off this time. Oh, and guess what? Oh, I'm so glad my phone rang. Okay, guess what my dad had to say.
That he's bringing the donuts for us on Wednesday.
Oh,
oh what?
He said, "What did one hydrogen atom say to the other?" And it was, "I think I'm missing a electron." And the other one said, "How do you know? Or are you sure?" Excuse me. And then the hydrogen atom said, "I'm positive."
That was almost as good as donuts.
That's all he did. That's all he called me for. And then I called him back and asked him if he had anything to say. He's like, nope, that was it. I'm Dr. Laura.
Well, are we through? Okay.